Next number is case 06-1208, Fisherman's Harvest and others against PBS&J. Mr. O'Fine.
May it please the court. My name is Paul O'Fine, and I do represent plaintiffs in this action, W.F. Childress, W.F. Childress Seafood, Alton McKelley, and I'm standing in for Senator David Burnson, who represents Fisherman's Harvest plaintiffs as well. Your Honor, as we look through this, this case is strictly about the jurisdiction of the Court of Federal Claims, and I believe it's also about whether or not a district court can transfer a case to another court without first analyzing its jurisdiction in the case for all of the claims, not just one of the claims, and that's what happened here in this case. When we look at the statute, Your Honor, Section 1497 of Title 28, that's the statute under which a oyster harvester may bring an action against the United States government, because that's what the waiver of the immunity
well,
is.
Counsel, it doesn't say against the government. This is a very hard case. And all of the other sections, 1491 and other sections that do provide jurisdiction to the Court of Federal Claims, say against the government, but this statute says any claims for damages. And that's the part that causes me pause.
I understand that, Your Honor. I will address that issue at this point in time. I agree that the statute could have probably been written a little bit more clearly. However, I don't think you can take Section 1497 on its own without considering the jurisdictional mandate of the court in the first place. The court was established so that the people would be able to sue the government, not private party contractors.
Well, what would you rather have Congress do? I mean, they didn't put the words against the government in here. I mean, maybe they should have put the words against anyone, including private parties, but that seems a little redundant, since everywhere else they have the words against the government. And certainly when they enacted 1497, they knew the jurisdiction of the Federal Claims Court was generally related to cases against the government. I mean, Congress was not unaware of that when they enacted this statute.
Well,
so
Your Honor,
it's difficult.
I don't know that they didn't know that. And I'm not sure that back then, as we've seen in some of the case law, that the legislative history of this case is very vague and scant. So it's not as, there's no interpretive value to the legislative history of this statute, Your Honor. But I would say this. When one looks at 1497, I don't think you can look at that in a vacuum. I think you have to look at it in context to 1491, the general jurisdictional statute. When you look at the general jurisdictional statute, it talks about the Federal Claims Court cannot hear claims sounding a tort exceeding $10,000. Therefore, it's a strict liability court against the government. There's no negligence actions. There's this 1497, Your Honor.
And I agree with you. That's the jurisdiction provided by 1491. But 1497 is unquestionably a separate grant of jurisdiction to the Court of Federal Claims. So why can't Congress dictate separate terms for that grant?
I was getting to that, Your Honor. The point I'm making, Your Honor, is that if you read 1497 by itself, without in context and without consistency with 1491, then 1497 means anything, and the court would go beyond its jurisdictional mandate. It says here, any claim. Well, then, can I sue for negligence? Can I sue for emotional damage? Can I sue? It opens up a whole litany of things that now I can sue for, and who can I sue? And I think that the Congress, their intent was, back in those days, the oyster harvester had no recourse against the government for dredging projects, because this was the New Deal era. And in the New Deal, they were looking to have projects to provide jobs for people. And the oyster harvester was taking it in the shorts because these dredging projects were damaging oyster beds throughout the country. And Congress said, you know, we've got to give these guys an opportunity to get asked after the government. That's why they came up with 1497, so they could go against the government. And again, the statute says it's talking about authorized by act of Congress, and anything authorized by act of Congress, I think, implies that it's the government that's undertaking this action to do this river and harbor improvement. Therefore, I think it's not a stretch to say it's limited to actions against the government. When you look at the entire jurisdictional mandate of the court, it's a court of limited jurisdiction to sue the United States government, not private parties. And in fact, Your Honor, when we talk about that, the Court of Claims just last week said that they had no jurisdiction as between private parties.
They said in general. No, that line in the opinion said, in general, we have no jurisdiction against private parties.
Yes, Your Honor, but it did involve the same very parties that are here today. And what was going on in that case was a realignment, because Weeks Marine could not bring in other private parties in conjunction with this oyster harvester's claim. They were not allowed to do that. In fact, they realigned them as a defendant as opposed to an intervener plaintiff. And I think that's very instructional for the court. They know what their jurisdiction is. And to sit there and say, and they also determined that the court did not have jurisdiction, or Weeks Marine could not sue the government, but until there was a liability imposed upon Weeks Marine first. And I think that's what has to be taken a look at here. I think, Your Honor, when we look at the case law that talks about this very court decided in 1999, with the Cook County case, that all the claims do not have to be transferred to the Court of Federal Claims. It can send up the claims that are appropriate to be there, and the ones that don't need to be there can be left in the district court. And we believe that this is a negligence action against private parties. We sued these people in what is essentially state tort law in a federal district court under diversity jurisdiction.
Mr. Arfine, as I understand it, the district court, in considering the transfer motion, recognized that the first question is whether the transferor court does not have jurisdiction. And in that context, the district court concluded that because the Court of Federal Claims has exclusive jurisdiction, in effect, it had no jurisdiction and had to transfer the case. Its decision on transfer, as I read it, is based on its conclusion that the Court of Federal Claims has exclusive jurisdiction over these questions. Am I reading it incorrectly?
Your Honor, I'm not sure that they determined that the court had exclusive jurisdiction over claims against private parties. It may have determined that it had exclusive jurisdiction over claims against
over the third party claim.
But not against, I don't believe they made that conclusion, Your Honor. I think he punted that one and said, I don't see any reason why these claims cannot go. He was using the language in the Voinovich case. It said, I don't see any exclusive jurisdiction, but I don't see any reason why they can't, therefore I'm punting it. And I believe they did not make the reasoned and well thought out analysis of the claim against the private parties. Had he done that, he could not have transferred this case under 1691 because he had to first determine he had no jurisdiction against
the district court certainly had jurisdiction over the tort claims because they were diversity claims sounding in negligence. It's just plain and simple tort action.
Yes, Your Honor, and he did not make a decision as to whether or not he did not have that jurisdiction. And I believe
and the district court also would have jurisdiction over the third party claim against the United States. That too sounded in tort, but that he had jurisdiction, or the district court had jurisdiction under the Federal Tort Claims Act. So the district court, it seems to me, had jurisdiction over both the complaint and the third party complaint, both of those causes of action. But in terms of the transfer, you're right. The analysis seemed to focus on the third party claim against the United States and then concluded based on the Vujinovich case and section 1497 that the jurisdiction over that third party action was exclusive with the Court of Federal Claims. And the question I have is, in reading section 1497, the language doesn't say exclusive. It says the Court of Federal Claims shall have jurisdiction, but doesn't say that its jurisdiction is exclusive.
Well, that's your point, isn't it?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better myself, Your Honor. I believe that you're correct. The point is that, with all due respect to the Court of Voinovich, they said, I don't see the exclusivity of it, but I'm transferring it. I don't see why.
Well, there wasn't any real analysis in that.
That's my point, Your Honor. That's why my whole point about the 1631 transfer requires an analysis, a three-part test as to whether or not could the claim have been originally brought in another court. First of all, the first question is, do I have jurisdiction or not? If I don't have jurisdiction, I've got to find out why I don't. And two, if there's another court that it can be transferred to, it had to be able to have been brought in that court originally. And I say, in this case, as a standalone private party case against another private party in the Court of Federal Claims. If you met that, then if it was in the interest of justice, then I think the analysis would have been proper, and then he could have transferred. He never made that analysis, and I don't believe, had he made the analysis, he would have never determined that he had no jurisdiction over the negligence tort actions under diversity.
Because the claim was not pled as a 1497 claim, even the third-party complaint.
Your Honor, I'm already out of my
time. You've exhausted all of your time, but you've yielded some, is that right, to Mr. D'Alessandris?
Yes, Your Honor, I have, and I was supposed to save some time for rebuttal, but apparently...
We'll see. We'll see how that works out.
Okay.
Mr. D'Alessandris, you're speaking for the engineers?
Yes, Your
Honor. You've shifted sides.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's more appropriate. I couldn't understand why you were listed as an appellee.
Don't know, Your Honor. We had filed a motion to realign the parties.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'd like to first respond to Judge Moore's question regarding the lack of specification in the statute stating that Congress didn't state that these were claims against the United States. And I'd like to point to the principle of statutory construction that the statute should be interpreted to avoid constitutional problems. Specifically, an interpretation arguing that this statute provided jurisdiction against private parties in the Court of Federal Claims would violate the Northern Pipeline versus Marathon Pipeline case by the Supreme Court. Specifically, they would be removing a case or controversy specifically allocated to Article III courts and moving it to an Article I court.
Well, I don't think it's so much an Article I issue, is it, as the whether or not the claim, in fact, is a claim against the government. And it looked, and with a cross-claim as mm-hmm. well, it looks very much, and if you go back to the legislative history, it becomes almost quite clear that that's exactly what they had in mind. The ultimate person, the ultimate liable party, not necessarily in tort, perhaps, because what's being done as a matter of public interest would be the United States. And if it's as simple as that, then the Court of Federal Claims and the move there and the reference to that court in 1497 fits in very well with the relationship between the Court of Federal Claims and the district courts.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor. The claim against...
Well, once the United States was brought into the case...
Yes, Your Honor.
It looks to me as if that is just what Congress foresaw in this highly specific statute, which plugged what was otherwise, according to the record, a very troublesome gap at a time when a lot of this dredging was taking place.
Yes, Your Honor, they did intend to move the claims against the United States to the Court of Federal Claims, but the claims in the district court were not pled against the Army Corps. They were simply tort claims against private parties, and that is a case, a matter of law or equity, which could be brought before an Article III court, and Congress can't remove that from the Article III court and move it to an Article I court because it's not a public rights issue. In the Northern Pipeline case, Congress mentioned that there were three types of cases that could be determined by Article I courts.
Well, you know, that doesn't really make sense because we know that Tucker Act claims can be brought in the district court and in the Court of Federal Claims.
Yes, but the constitutional infirmity would be taking an Article III issue to an Article I court. There's nothing that prevents them from...
They just go back and forth if the $10,000 limit is exceeded.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
I'm troubled by your concentrating on the difference between Article I and Article III when we really have a statute, perhaps not so clear. Mm-hmm. That's why we're here, as to what the congressional intent was. Not that this case couldn't move back and forth, but in fact, when Congress assigned these cases to the Court of Federal Claims, mm-hmm. without saying that the United States must be the first defendant, it couldn't have been transferred but for the cross claim against the United States, the set off or the reimbursement. Or whatever.
Correct, Your Honor.
However we call it.
We don't dispute that any claim by the oyster growers against the United States should be in the Court of Federal Claims. The only question is whether the Court of Federal Claims has jurisdiction over separate state law tort actions between the private plaintiffs and the private defendants that don't involve the United States. And those claims, we don't believe, could be transferred properly.
But this claim was not absolutely limited to negligence, was it?
On
the part of the dredges? The fact that the oyster beds were injured was viewed as an inexorable consequence of performing the actions that the engineers retained the dredging companies to perform.
No, Your Honor, I believe the claim by the plaintiffs below was strictly a negligence and gross negligence claim against the contractors. They did not involve, the Army Corps was not an initial defendant in that case. It was only brought in by the dredgers. And their claim against the United States was a tort claim against the United States, not a claim pursuant to the contract. Now, admittedly, the Court of Federal Claims could reconstruct that claim and treat it as a contract claim. I believe this court's opinion in Wood says that even a negligently performed contract is a tort in the performance of a contract is still a contract claim for Tucker Act jurisdiction. So certainly there is some sort of a claim out there that would be cognizable in the Court of Federal Claims between Weeks in the United States. But between
if the plaintiff in this case had brought one suit against both the government and the private party defendants, where would be appropriate for that suit, in your opinion?
I think the claim against the United States would need to be removed to the Court of Federal Claims, and the claim against the dredger would need to remain in the district court.
There is powerful precedent, case after case, against that sort of redundant litigation of identical issues. In one court or another, it arises primarily under issues of federalism between state and federal courts. Mm-hmm. But as between two federal courts, I would think the same principles and policy would be very strong unless it were prohibited.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, we cited to the Finley case, the Supreme Court case, regarding ancillary jurisdiction or pendant party jurisdiction, and I think it's similar to that, where Ms. Finley had a tort claim, a Federal Tort Claim Act against the United States, and was also suing San Diego Gas and Electric, and I believe the San Diego municipality. And they tried to move everything into the federal court to prevent redundant jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court still said, you know, despite the fact that the Federal Tort Claim Act required this to be litigated in state court, they shouldn't be taking jurisdiction over these, in federal court, they shouldn't be taking these state court claims into the federal court. And the fact that Ms. Finley was required to litigate in two separate courts was unfortunate, but that was what Congress had permitted.
But there was also a question as to whether the operative facts in each case were in fact identical. Mm-hmm. Or, as I recall that case, it isn't that clear in my mind. I mean, that wasn't the only reason, as I recall, for that decision.
No, Your Honor, but I just meant that the Supreme Court recognized that sometimes with the waiver of sovereign immunity that you have to litigate in separate courts.
Sometimes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Alessandris. Mr. Engerand? Thank you.
May it please the Court. We are here today because of the government's dominant navigational servitude, as you recognized earlier. That dominant servitude comes from an oyster dredging case, the Lewis Blue Point case, which fills the legislative history of this statute. That case involved a suit against a dredging company for damage to oyster leases in a bay, very much like this one. The government said, because of the grant of the people to Congress in Article 1, Section 7, that the people had given their full power over that subject matter to Congress, such that the owner of that lease has no property right whatsoever against this kind of navigational improvement. Now, it also said, beside the fact that they have no property right, that the navigational servitude is absolute and dominant, and it is one of the greatest powers given to the federal government. And I, as an Admiralty professor for 28 years, this is my Bible, here, the Federalist Papers. And I was reading those again on my way up here. And it's not Shay's Rebellion that fills the Federalist Papers. It is discussion of the importance of the fact that our republic was going to fail were the power of interstate and international commerce not given to the federal government. And the Supreme Court has recognized that in case after case after case, including the Lewis Blue Point case involving oyster leases, saying that there is no right whatsoever against the government or against the contractor. And the cases have come down after that, including decisions. There's a more recent case where even the Cherokee Nation was granted absolute power over its land in Oklahoma, and yet when a contractor comes in the Arkansas River and causes damage to their land, the Cherokees had no right whatsoever to recover damages.
Counsel, if the defendant hadn't brought the government into this litigation, could it be removed to the Court of Federal Claims?
Absolutely, Your Honor, because I believe that using the legislative history that we have here today, and that legislative history comes then in the next case that was the Randell case.
So you just let me make sure I understand. So you think if it was purely a private versus private suit, no government involvement at all formally as a party on either side, that you think this cause of action could be brought in the Court of Federal Claims under 1497?
Absolutely. The reason being that I believe the language is exclusive because Congress recognized...
Okay, what about jury trials?
There's no need for a jury trial, and the reason
for that...
But
isn't there a right to one? And that's what concerns one of the things that concerns
me. There's no right whatsoever to
under the Seventh Amendment?
Absolutely not. They're
even negligence?
They're even in admiralty. They don't have a right in admiralty to a jury trial.
They're not suing under an admiralty. They're suing under negligence, state tort law.
This is an admiralty case. It's damaged by a vessel to land, so under the Admiralty Extension Act, it's absolutely swept in. And no matter what they plead, it's going to be admiralty law. But nonetheless, because there is no private cause of action whatsoever, and now that there is legislation, there's case law. For example, the Supreme Court has ruled subsequently in the Yearsley case that the fact that there is legislation now excludes liability of the government's representative acting on behalf in the taking of their property. That's 309 U.S. 18, the Yearsley case. They have no cause of action whatsoever against any of these contractors at law.
Isn't there a difference between a takings case and a negligence case?
Well, Your Honor, that would be the case, except for the fact that all of these suits were brought against contractors. Suits are brought against contractors for negligence. And all of us contractors here who come today to support me, the answer is that our immunity is derivative of the government's. And we have no liability because when we act on behalf of the government, we are insulated from liability. So the thing is, knowing that, Congress has passed this statute, and they knew that going in. The legislative history set forth, and I urge you to read those committee reports in the Andrew Radel case because they're just amazing. But once you have that, then the government is allowed to create, once there is sovereign immunity, and to use the government's case here, which is Northern Pipeline, once there is sovereign immunity, the government has the right, since our immunity is derivative of theirs, the government has the right to say, you can be sued or not sued. You can be sued in this court or that court. You can be sued with a jury. It could be an administrative agency. The government has taken, for example, the Longshore and Harbor Workers Act and put it in an administrative agency.
Once the government was in the case, and it looks as if nobody in the government never said, all right, well, whatever you contractors did, we're not going to be liable. I gather that there was not a barrier interposed between the contractors and the government. Is that right? So that once the government was in the case, in some ways it simplifies the issue, doesn't it, on the question that Judge Moore asked, because it's very hard to take the hurdle of the Court of Federal Claims deciding under 1497 that the government shall pay up, in which case it would, I think, almost have to be a Fifth Amendment case rather than tort action, however negligent the contractors might have been if, in fact, they were doing negligent work at the behest of the government. So do we have to decide, because I don't know of any other case where the Court of Federal Claims has, in fact, rendered judgment against private parties as between private parties. So there's a sort of intellectual hurdle that, from looking at the legislative history briefly, looks as if nobody really pointed out to Congress. They were plugging the gap that you have mentioned. We can't have this wrong without a right, when it's just a matter of technicalities of the Constitution.
Everything,
there's no remedy.
Excuse me. Everything you say is exactly right. It's exactly the situation that's faced in this exact situation here, and that was that Congress is faced with a situation where the contractors have no liability, the government has no liability. There's no liability whatsoever in this circumstance where there is a dredging project carried on, authorized by Congress, over navigable waters. The navigational servitude trumps it completely. So Congress passes this statute, and this statute says actually it doesn't say any claims, at first it says claims, and then they amend it and make it even stronger and say any claims in a subsequent amendment, when they could have said against the government at that time or anything else they wanted, but they didn't. They only broadened it to say any claims. So the thing that they have done is they've taken a situation where there is no liability against any of these parties, and they have said now any claims for damages to the oyster growers are brought in the Court of Federal Claims. So the question then is it all of the claims, or then are we just completely free elsewhere because there's no liability elsewhere? So the only place that we can be liable, the only place that any of this can be addressed, it is the exclusive place where it can be addressed because there's no other place where it can be addressed, is in the Court of Federal Claims.
You say there's no liability elsewhere, but this action was not pled as a taking of a property interest, as in Lewis. It was pled as a tort claim, as simple negligence.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying that that's not actionable?
It is not actionable when the contractors are acting in the course of the work that's been given to them by the Corps of Engineers. Yearsley, that I mentioned to you, is an example of that.
There's a separate claim, isn't there, by the plaintiff against the government actually pending in the Court of Federal Claims?
There are actually four claims.
What is the cause of action they allege there against the government?
They had brought two claims against the government for their damages under 1497.
They plead it right against 1497. It's not sort of enumerated in some way, negligence or breach of contract. I mean, there's no sort of...
I don't remember how they pled it, Your Honor. I don't remember how they pled it, but...
It must be under the Fifth Amendment, don't you think?
That's what I was wondering.
But they had... there's this... knowing that they had no right after Lewis, which Congress called the famous Lewis case in the legislative history, knowing that there was no right, this statute was passed to be the one and only right. And the language of it is, whether it's concurrent or exclusive is really irrelevant, because the district court did transfer it. If there's concurrent jurisdiction, certainly for purposes of completeness, since the one remedy is admitted to be exclusive, then it's exclusive on the one hand, maybe it's not exclusive on the other, I don't know. I don't think the same words do that. But legislative history being what it is, that Congress knew there was nothing else, and it was dominum obsque injuria.
But if in fact the government were now, if this case proceeds in the Court of Federal Claims, were to say, I told those contractors, leave the oyster beds alone, and they didn't, and acted negligently, then again we're back to where we were before. These injured parties are out in the cold. They've been transferred out of the district court where a negligence case could have proceeded against the contractors. They're out of the Court of Federal Claims because the United States has perhaps shown that it was that there were circumstances that they're not responsible for. So having everything, well, even as I speak, it's a difficult case because the idea is to assure that if there is a wrong to be righted, whatever it's called, that again we don't end up with some kind of technicality where all the doors in the courthouses are shut.
That is why, and that is specifically why, I believe the district judge transferred the case so that all parties would be before one court. That court has ample jurisdiction under the exact words of Congress. Just as you were talking, Judge Moore, about the word either, I think the word any is pretty good as well. And all of that can be resolved in one court. It doesn't matter whether it's an Article I or Article III court because Congress's authority over this is plenary under the Navigational Servitude. It fits. I will take the Northern Pipeline case. We fit like a glove. The Northern Pipeline case says it doesn't matter because it's a public right. Lewis itself, the Lewis Oyster case, says this is a public right. And so Lewis and Northern Pipeline fit together perfectly. Sovereign immunity is also mentioned in that case. Our immunity, to the extent that there is any, is completely derivative of the government's. The government's immunity is certain. So there's no Northern Pipeline issue here whatsoever. All of the matters can be resolved together in one case. There will be no way that there's dominum obsque in juria because one judge will be deciding all of those issues, and it will be
Counsel,
coming back to this court to resolve.
Just in case we have to reach this issue about whether the jurisdiction is exclusive or concurrent, your position is that it is exclusive.
Having read the legislative history, it is absolutely exclusive. Congress knew that there was no other remedy whatsoever and put it here in the Court of Federal Claims. But that is a red herring. I argue it because I believe it.
Even for private parties?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Because Congress could have said anything they wanted. If they wanted, here's the answer to that. If there is a remedy against the contractors, it is here because they have no remedy elsewhere. If Congress intended them to have a remedy against the contractors, it is only in the Court of Federal Claims. But nonetheless, it doesn't need to be exclusive. It need only be concurrent because the judge actually, in this case was pled as a federal question case. There wasn't a federal question. The judge had the authority. He had to transfer the government's case. He certainly had the authority to transfer this. There is no Finley problem in this case because, frankly, Finley talks about a suit under the FTCA, and in that particular circumstance, they said that that's because the language of the FTCA says suits against the United States. Ours does not say suits against the United States.
Before your time runs out, I'd like to ask one more question. So in terms of determining exclusive or concurrent, I know you don't think we have to decide it, but I want to talk about it again. I'm troubled by the fact that 1497 doesn't say exclusive jurisdiction when lots of other sections of the code do. I know 1491 doesn't say exclusive, and yet we've interpreted it to mean exclusive, but there may be other reasons for that. The one thing that caused me pause about not saying it's exclusive, and tell me if you agree with this, is if it's not exclusive, then isn't there a right to bring a cause of action against the government in any district court, which I don't think they've waived their sovereign immunity for under this act?
That's right, Your Honor, because it's either exclusive or not.
For everybody.
For everybody.
Right.
It doesn't make a difference.
The statute doesn't say exclusive for exclusive for government, but not exclusive for private parties. That would require really finessing it far too much for me.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
You referred to the legislative history. What in particular are you referring to?
The hearings that in the Randell case, it refers to that statute that was the first attempt that Congress made when Mr. Randell was distressed because the silt came onto his leases and it was completely destroyed.
But I'm looking for the particular legislative history that you're referring to.
It's in the case cited in our opinion, but I can give it to you. The 69th Congress, first session, 1926. On March 4th, 1926, there were hearings before the Senate Subcommittee on Claims. And then there were two reports, the House Report 1285 and the Senate Report 332, in which they refer to the famous Lewis Blue Point case. Mm-hmm. And discuss the fact that there's no question that there was absolutely no right to recover. And so Congress created a special law just for Mr. Radel, just for him. When they then had to, in 1935, do the dredging in all the bays across the country, including our own in Texas, they put in that statute, not in any other statute, but in the dredging statute, they put this provision to give the Court of Claims jurisdiction and then amended it later to add any claims.
Thank you.
The one thing I would say before I go is as I was thinking about this, I would like to quote the great Daniel Webster, who argued down the street in the famous Gibbons versus Ogden case, and you know that's the case that gave the federal government power over navigation. When he ended his argument after a week of arguing before the court, not 15 minutes, and he said, if the federal government did not have the full power compared to the state of New York over navigation, which gave it to the federal government, then the court will look upon this scene of ruin, quoting Aeneas to Achates, quis iam locus, what place on earth is not filled with stories of our hardship. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Dangerin. Are you providing the rebuttal, Mr. D'Alessandro?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Are you
yes.
The rebutter? Because we'll restore some for Mr. O'Finan as well.
I had reserved 1 minute, Your Honor.
Okay, well, you can go first.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just wanted to point out, Weeks Marine talked about the Lewis case being an example of public rights. In the Lewis case, it was argued under a takings theory, and naturally under the Tucker Act, that takings claim would have belonged in the Court of Federal Claims anyway. This case here, they're arguing a negligence claim under state law in the district court, which would not belong in the Court of Federal Claims. I'd also just like to point out, Your Honor, that Weeks has asserted a government contract or immunity defense in the district court. Should their claim of immunity prevail in the district court, they would, of course, be able to have that claim dismissed. They can present that defense, that government contract or immunity defense, in the district court, and they've done so.
And then what happens? Then they ask to be transferred to the Court of Federal Claims for what's left.
But they're already there in the Court of Federal Claims, Your Honor.
Okay, I thought you said they'd be dismissed in the district court.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The tort claims by the private plaintiffs.
Yes.
Against Weeks Marine would belong in the district court. If they did the government contract or immunity, they're already suing the government, and Weeks Marine is a third-party defendant in their case in the Court of Federal Claims currently, so they're already there.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Mr. D'Alessandro. Mr. O'Finan, we'll restore
your
rebuttal time. Everyone's run over.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Can you answer that question that I raised, the other counsel didn't know the answer to? What is the cause of action that the plaintiffs are asserting against the government in the Court of Federal Claims case?
Strict liability under 1497.
Okay.
As I want to state, the claims again in the court below, Your Honor, pure negligence under state tort law. And the issues are not identical to the ones that are in the Court of Federal Claims as against the government. They're not identical. And one of the things that must be noted, I want to reiterate, Lewis Blue Point was an eminent domain case. And the reason the governmental contractors had immunity in that is because the government was taking river bottoms for navigation. They were cutting through, deliberately cutting across oyster leases as opposed to damaging them to aid navigation in other places. They were taking the land, and the injunction was denied to them. And when the governmental contractor acted in accordance strictly with the governmental contract requiring them to cut through the oyster bed, they had governmental immunity. And that governmental immunity, Your Honor, was reinforced in the Agent Orange cases in the 1970s. And governmental contractor immunity is an affirmative defense which requires it to be pled and proved. They've got to prove up all the elements. And one of the strictest elements of that, Your Honor, is that they have to prove up that, number one, they did the contract strictly in accordance with the specifications. And before they undertake the contract, they must examine it. And if they determine that if they do this strictly in accordance with the specifications, they're going to harm third parties, they must inform the government of that and ask them to restructure. Or if the government says, we're aware of that, we're going to make you do that anyway, that's when their immunity attaches, not before that. So they're putting the cart before the horse in this case. They're already assuming that they automatically have this immunity. It is not automatic. It's an affirmative defense that must be proved. It must be pled and proved, and there are several elements to it, of which they haven't proved up any of them at this point in time. And I think that's what's instructive. This is a case, state tort law case. They have yet to show me anything that says we don't have a right of action for negligence in the performance of their contract, whether they're a governmental contractor or not. Their contract tells them that they must not perform this contract and that they are responsible for their own negligence. Therefore, our cause of action against these private parties is in the district court or the state court. In fact, we sued them in the state court, and they removed it to the federal court, citing diversity of jurisdiction. They didn't say to the state court, remove this to the Court of Federal Claims because they're exclusive. They removed it to the federal district court. Then they cried, let's go to the Court of Federal Claims. So they themselves admitted that there was diversity of jurisdiction when this thing was first removed.
Now, you said the issues are not identical, but certainly the occurrence is identical, the facts giving rise to the cause of action are identical. I'm concerned about the duplicativeness of having two courts adjudicate this and the potential for double recovery by the plaintiff.
I'll explain why they're not the same, Your Honor.
Okay.
Real quickly. This project was not just a dredging to improve navigation. It was also, normally they take that dredge material and put it on dry land. In this case, somebody decided, let's create a bird sanctuary. Let's create beneficial use sites. That's not an aid to navigation. When they built these beneficial use sites, which are artificial islands, they built them with defective materials that the materials are now leaking from these islands and getting on the oyster leases, and that's how they're being damaged. So in reality, they weren't dredging along a channel and inadvertently spilled something on an oyster lease. It was dredging through a channel that was far removed from where the oyster lease was. They carried the dredge material to an area right next to the oyster lease and created an island, and it was the failure of their island engineering and the technology and the materials that they used to create this island failed. That's why the oyster leases are being damaged. So it's not just an aid to navigation case. It goes beyond that. That's what I'm saying. And this is very narrowly focused on an aid to navigation, but in fact it is not. It is the creation of beneficial use sites and a dredging operation. Therefore, the negligence arises in the usage and the construction of what they call geotubes, the placement of the geotubes. That has nothing to do with aid in navigation. In fact, it's probably a hindrance to navigation because...
Just real quick, is the creation of this bird sanctuary something that would be categorized as making river and harbor improvements authorized by Congress?
Your Honor, I would not categorize it as that because the making of river and harbor improvements is for navigation. They want to be able to get ships through. You know, harbor improvement is so that a non-shallow draft craft, but a very deep draft craft, can get through that area. Houston is notorious for shoals and reefs and things of that nature. And we have a ship channel that is very narrow and gets it to the ports for where you get all your gasoline from going through right by our oyster leases. But those leases are not in an navigable waterway. In fact, it would be totally impractical to cut a channel through that waterway. Unlike in the Lewis Blue Point, they decided they could cut a channel and create an artificial channel, unlike a canal. But that's not the case in the Trinity River.
You're not relying on any of these subsequent legislative acts to provide remedies for the oyster farmers.
I think the act of the claim against the government, I think we have to rely upon 1497 to get any relief from the government. But we believe that relief from the government is very limited in scope and nature, and that They specifically limited it to maybe one crop, maybe two crops. Future damages are very speculative. However, with the negligence action, and when they build these beneficial use sites in the negligence, these oyster harvesters are going to be damaged many years into the future.
Because let me just make sure I understand the answer to my question. You are relying then on 1497?
As to against the government only, Your Honor. We're relying on state negligent tort law as to the private parties. We believe the claims are separate and distinct and have different operative facts because the dredging operation itself was limited and the beneficial use site creation is a completely different issue than dredging and making harbor improvements.
Are you saying your third party complaint in this case relies on 1497?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
The third party complaint in this case?
You're talking about the complaint by Weeks Marine against the United States government?
Yes.
I'm not sure, again, I understand the question. If you're explaining to me,
is that a negligence claim or a 1497 claim?
I think the third party complaint against the government by Weeks Marine, Your Honor, is a contract dispute between the government and Weeks Marine. I don't think that has any bearing upon whether or not I can sue the private parties for negligence in state court or under diversity in district court. I think they're mutually exclusive of each other.
So the action you were referring to under 1497 is the action you filed in the Court of Federal Claims.
Yes. The other, it's not this action. You're not talking about this action.
That's what,
that's what I had.
I'm trying to keep those separate. I think that's where the lines are getting blurred between these.
All right. That's the only point I wanted.
Distinct and separate actions. Here.
Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you,
Mr. O'Finan, Mr. Dallas Anderson, and Mr. Ingram.